The clock is ticking. A desperate man holds his family at gunpoint, threatening to pull the trigger. Across the line, an FBI negotiator must find the right words, words that could save lives or, if poorly chosen, cost them. This delicate psychological dance between captor and negotiator forms the heart of Gary Noesner's riveting memoir, Stalling for Time, which has become required reading for law enforcement agencies worldwide. As the FBI's first chief negotiator, Noesner pioneered techniques that transformed crisis management from brute force to strategic communication. His methods have influenced everything from corporate conflict resolution to international diplomacy. Even Hollywood took notice. The 2018 film Beirut drew inspiration from his overseas hostage recovery work. What makes this book particularly compelling is how it reveals that the most powerful weapon in a crisis isn't a gun or tactical gear, but something far more fundamental, the ability to truly listen. When Charlie threatened to kill his wife Cheryl during a tense standoff in rural Virginia, Noesner faced a critical moment that would define his approach to negotiation. "I'm not going to kill myself," Charlie had declared, his voice trembling with rage and desperation. "You're gonna have to kill me." As Charlie pressed a .357 Magnum against Cheryl's temple, while their terrified 8-year-old son watched from just feet away, Noesner desperately sought any connection that might prevent an impending tragedy. The negotiation dance began with Noesner methodically trying different approaches, each carefully calculated yet delivered with genuine concern. When emotional appeals to Charlie's love for his son failed to break through, Noesner seized on Charlie's demand for a helicopter, a request he'd heard countless times in hostage situations. Rather than dismissing it as unrealistic, he used it strategically, positioning himself as Charlie's advocate while quietly coordinating with tactical teams. "I'm working on that helicopter for you," Noesner assured Charlie, gradually building rapport through meandering conversations about hunting, woodsmanship, and their experiences as fathers. This case exemplifies Noesner's core philosophy. Effective negotiation isn't about clever manipulation or psychological tricks, but creating genuine human connection amid chaos. He established trust through active listening techniques, repeating Charlie's concerns back to him, acknowledging his feelings without judgment, and finding small points of agreement. These weren't just theoretical concepts, but practical tools that helped penetrate the fog of crisis. The same techniques that worked with Charlie, patience, empathy, and strategic honesty, became foundational principles in modern crisis negotiation training. The outcome proved bittersweet. After 11 grueling hours, when Charlie finally emerged from the house using his family as human shields, FBI snipers took their shot when a brief gap appeared between Charlie and his son. Though Charlie died instantly, his wife and child survived physically unharmed. Months later, Cheryl wrote to Noesner, "Your voice was so soothing during that horrible time. Charlie ended up liking you and wished he could have met you under different circumstances. You tried so hard to save everyone." This paradox, forming a genuine connection with someone you may ultimately help neutralize, highlights the profound emotional complexity of negotiation work. Noesner felt no remorse about recommending deadly force when necessary, understanding that his primary duty was saving innocent lives. Yet each case left its mark, teaching valuable lessons about human nature under extreme stress. This pragmatic compassion defines the negotiator's mindset. Connect authentically with subjects while maintaining clear boundaries and objectives. Always remembering that success means preserving life whenever possible, even when perfect outcomes remain elusive. Through cases like Charlie's, Noesner developed a comprehensive approach that balanced emotional intelligence with tactical necessity, demonstrating that even in life's darkest moments, skilled negotiation can illuminate paths to resolution. His methods proved that words, wielded with expertise and genuine concern, could be as powerful as any weapon in the crisis negotiator's arsenal. Knosner's path to becoming the FBI's chief negotiator emerged from a crucible of high-stakes international terrorism cases. In the early 1980s, he immersed himself in counterterrorism work, with the 1985 TWA Flight 847 hijacking marking a pivotal moment. The brutal murder of U.S. Navy diver Robert Dean Stethem during this incident left an indelible mark on Knosner. For 5 painstaking years, he traversed multiple continents, meticulously building evidence against terrorist Muhammad Ali Hamadeh, learning firsthand the complexity of international investigations and the human cost of terrorism. The Achille Lauro cruise ship hijacking in 1985 presented another watershed moment. Palestinian terrorists seized the vessel, culminating in the shocking murder of Leon Klinghoffer, a 69-year-old wheelchair-bound American who was shot and thrown overboard. In Turin's maximum security prison, Knosner faced hijacker Majed al-Mulki, whose initial demeanor radiated pure hatred. Rather than resort to aggressive tactics, Knosner employed subtle psychological techniques. He deliberately softened his approach, spoke in al-Mulki's native Palestinian Arabic dialect, and began with mundane questions about the hijacker's background and family. This gradual trust-building process transformed the interview, leading to al-Mulki's eventual confession about Klinghoffer's murder. This pivotal interrogation fundamentally shaped Knosner's philosophy about human interaction under extreme pressure. He observed that rapport-building techniques consistently outperformed confrontational approaches, even with hardened terrorists. The success reinforced his growing conviction that emotional intelligence and cultural sensitivity were as crucial as tactical expertise. The Egypt Air Flight 648 hijacking in 1985 provided a stark contrast in crisis management approaches. Maltese authorities, lacking trained negotiators, adopted a passive stance while waiting for Egyptian commandos. This decision proved catastrophic. The resulting assault involved excessive force, with commandos using military-grade explosives and automatic weapons in confined spaces. The death toll exceeded 65 people, many of them innocent passengers caught in the crossfire. This tragedy underscored the vital importance of skilled negotiation in preventing unnecessary casualties. The relentless pace of international terrorism work took its toll on Knosner. Spending at least half of each year away from his wife and young children, he witnessed the personal cost of dedication to such high-stakes cases. The breaking point came with the Pan Am Flight 103 Lockerbie bombing in December 1988. Rather than lead another exhausting international investigation, Knosner made the career-altering decision to transfer to the Special Operations and Research Unit at Quantico. At Quantico, Knosner revolutionized the FBI's approach to crisis negotiation. He completely overhauled the training curriculum, recognizing that most field negotiators dealt more frequently with domestic crises than international terrorism. He emphasized active listening skills and crisis intervention techniques, developing a comprehensive program that balanced theoretical understanding with practical application. His famous principle, "Listening is the cheapest yet most effective concession we can make," became the cornerstone of modern FBI negotiation training. This approach proved particularly effective in diffusing emotionally charged situations, from domestic disputes to barricade scenarios, demonstrating that empathy and understanding could achieve what force often couldn't. The 1991 Talladega prison uprising tested Knosner's negotiation philosophy when Cuban detainees seized control of their unit at the Federal Correctional Institution in Alabama, taking 11 hostages. Many were Mariel Boatlift refugees awaiting repatriation to Cuba. And unlike previous Cuban prison riots, these inmates initially refused to negotiate, having learned that prolonged discussions typically favored authorities. As negotiation team leader, Knosner assessed that hunger would provide their best leverage since inmates had no kitchen access. He introduced aromatic warfare, cooking bacon and coffee near the unit to tempt the starving inmates. This creative strategy finally prompted communication after days of silence. 7 days into the standoff, inmates released one hostage in exchange for meeting with a Spanish-language reporter. The freed hostage warned that leadership among inmates was deteriorating, with dangerous individuals gaining influence. When inmates allowed medical checks for the remaining hostages, a disguised FBI medic received desperate notes indicating imminent executions. This intelligence prompted preparation for tactical assault. While tactical teams rehearsed, Nosner emphasized that negotiations should continue to maximize chances for the hostages' safe recovery. The negotiation team developed a strategy to lull inmates into complacency by providing a rich feast without preconditions. At 3:43 a.m., 10 days into the siege, HRT and SWAT teams executed a perfectly coordinated assault, freeing all hostages without firing a shot. Talladega represented the ideal integration of negotiation and tactical operations. Negotiations had softened opposition and gained critical intelligence, enabling tactical forces to succeed without bloodshed. Yet despite this perfect integration, the Bureau didn't fully appreciate the negotiation team's contribution. This imbalance between negotiation and tactical approaches would soon have tragic consequences at Ruby Ridge in 1992, where anti-government separatist Randy Weaver and his family barricaded themselves in their remote Idaho cabin. HRT Commander Dick Rogers implemented rules of engagement that permitted snipers to shoot all armed adult males outside the cabin without warning, rules later deemed unconstitutional. An HRT sniper wounded Weaver and accidentally killed his wife, Vicky, who was holding their baby daughter. Ruby Ridge became a rallying cry for anti-government militias and would later help motivate the Oklahoma City bombing. It also foreshadowed an even more catastrophic standoff that would define Nosner's career, Waco. The 1993 standoff with David Koresh and the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas, represents the most painful chapter in Nosner's career, a tragedy that might have been avoided had negotiation strategies prevailed over tactical impatience. The Branch Davidians, a breakaway sect of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, led by self-proclaimed sinful messiah David Koresh, had stockpiled weapons and lived communally at their Mount Carmel compound. After a disastrous ATF raid left 4 agents and 5 Davidians dead, the FBI took over, with Nosner leading negotiations. From the beginning, Nosner established a trickle, flow, and gush strategy, building trust through small successes that would gradually lead to surrender. This approach yielded immediate results. Within days, Koresh released 12 children. Each child carried notes about where they should be sent, and negotiators would call to confirm each child's safe arrival, allowing parents to verify their well-being. By establishing this pattern of trust and verification, Nosner's team created momentum toward resolution. However, a fundamental philosophical divide emerged between the negotiation team and tactical commanders. Despite Nosner's protests, FBI SAC Jeff Jamar ordered Bradley armored vehicles onto Davidian property as a show of force, which immediately damaged credibility with Koresh's lieutenant Steve Schneider, who angrily accused them of breaking promises. Communication between negotiators, located 8 miles away, and HRT, positioned near the compound, deteriorated, creating a dangerous disconnect. The tactical team repeatedly undermined negotiation progress. HRT Commander Dick Rogers, emboldened by the Talladega success rather than chastened by Ruby Ridge, remained committed to aggressive approaches. They installed high-powered lights aimed at the compound and authorized combat engineering vehicles to clear debris piles near the compound, actions that Davidians perceived as hostile. Perhaps the strangest element was blasting bizarre sounds, Tibetan chants, dying rabbit recordings, and Nancy Sinatra's "These Boots Are Made for Walking" over loudspeakers at night. Despite these obstacles, Nosner's negotiation efforts continued yielding results. Between March 19 to 23, they secured the release of 9 more Davidians, bringing the total to 35 people safely out. However, after one particularly destructive tactical operation on March 25, Koresh angrily declared, "No one else will be coming out." When Nosner confronted Jamar about these counterproductive tactics, he dismissed the concerns, fixated on forcing a faster resolution due to mounting costs, $128,000 daily, and public pressure. On March 25, after 4 exhausting weeks, Nosner was replaced as negotiation coordinator by Clint Van Zandt. No further Davidians would exit after his departure. On April 19, when the FBI deployed tear gas, the Davidians responded with gunfire. Fires erupted throughout the compound, resulting in 75 deaths in what investigations confirmed was a mass suicide. Koresh died of a gunshot wound to the head, apparently fired by Schneider, who then killed himself. Waco became a self-inflicted wound for the FBI that damaged public trust. Subsequent inquiries confirmed that the negotiation team had been on the right track, while tactical commanders had made critical errors. The tragedy demonstrated the dangers of impatience and the fatal consequences of undermining negotiation efforts with aggressive tactical moves. The 81-day standoff with the Montana Freeman in 1996 offered Nosner an opportunity to redeem the FBI's approach to crisis management after Waco's failures. The Freemen were a radical anti-government group who believed themselves sovereign citizens, refusing to recognize federal authority. They committed financial fraud through false liens and bogus checks, threatened officials, and once took over a Jordan City Council meeting at gunpoint. Unlike the ATF's frontal assault at Waco, Nosner implemented a measured approach after arresting the Freeman leaders away from their compound. FBI agents and Montana Highway Patrol established loose perimeters, wearing casual clothes rather than intimidating tactical gear, and allowing local ranchers through checkpoints to minimize the siege atmosphere. When direct communication failed, they implemented a two-track approach using intermediaries. Montana legislator Carl Oss proved invaluable, a Republican rancher who knew one Freeman's father and who, even on horseback when roads became impassable, was always welcomed by the Freeman when other intermediaries were rejected. Unlike at Waco, FBI Director Louis Free personally supported their patient approach, including Nosner in all daily teleconferences with on-site management. When some mid-level managers grew impatient with the siege's duration, Freed decisively ended such complaints. "Gary, it's important for you to know that as your director, I am in no hurry to end this incident. I want to make sure that we take whatever time necessary to negotiate this out the right way." The negotiators rotated all FBI personnel to prevent burnout, with Nosner's deputy Steve Romano alternating two-week leadership stints with him. This siege was unique. Their perimeter was loosely defined, and negotiations happened only through intermediaries during daylight hours. The breakthrough came when Edwin Clark, a likable, down-to-earth man who owned the land, expressed growing frustration with the other's intransigence while showing concern for his family members inside who needed medical attention. In an unprecedented move, the FBI flew Edwin to meet with imprisoned Freeman leader Leroy Schweitzer, who surprisingly blessed the surrender. On the 81st day, the longest siege in U.S. history ended peacefully as the Freemen surrendered one by one at the cattle guard. Even one of the Cause Foundation representatives, a longtime FBI critic, had tears in his eyes, telling Nosner he was proud to witness such a professional operation. This success validated the negotiation program and provided redemption after Waco and Ruby Ridge. As Edwin said when it ended, "Well, boys, we had a hell of a siege, didn't we?" Throughout his career, Nosner discovered that negotiation principles could be applied far beyond traditional hostage situations. In the Republic of Texas standoff in 1997, he worked alongside Texas Rangers to confront armed militants led by Richard McLaren, who claimed Texas was illegally annexed in 1845 and was actually a sovereign nation. When McLaren's group kidnapped neighbors Joe and Margaret Ann Rowe over a land dispute, Nosner recommended a parallel approach, negotiating in good faith while demonstrating tactical capability. Working with DPS spokesman Mike Cox, they crafted key media messages emphasizing this was a Texas matter, highlighting ROT's hypocrisy, stressing their commitment to dialogue, and making clear warrants would be served. When follower Paulson showed signs of wavering, they identified the ROT chain of command and secured a surrender order from their president, Halbison. After deploying a show of force with tanks and officers, McLaren's wife, Evelyn, surrendered first. They negotiated a face-saving ceasefire agreement that allowed McLaren to surrender with dignity. In 2000, Nosner led a team removing protesters from Navy bombing ranges in Vieques Island, Puerto Rico. Despite the FBI's initial reluctance to get involved, they successfully employed negotiation-first tactics. By having Spanish-speaking negotiators approach protesters calmly and respectfully before tactical teams, they achieved a peaceful resolution that garnered positive media coverage. The FBI's negotiation successes led to global involvement in over 120 international kidnappings. In the 1996 MRTA hostage crisis in Peru, President Fujimori's tactical approach ultimately succeeded when commandos detonated explosives beneath the residents during the terrorists' daily soccer game. Though one hostage, two commandos, and all terrorists died, 77 hostages were rescued. Nosner worried other governments would focus only on the successful outcome without recognizing that Fujimori had been very, very lucky by placing all his eggs in the tactical basket without meaningful negotiations. The crisis led to positive developments. The creation of the International Negotiation Working Group, INWG, including 15 countries, and the National Council of Negotiation Associations, which established national negotiation standards. By 1998, the FBI elevated the negotiation program to create the Crisis Negotiation Unit with Nosner as its first chief. Nosner's 30-year FBI career culminated in the D.C. sniper case in 2002, a massive multi-agency effort tracking down John Muhammad and Lee Boyd Malvo, who terrorized the Washington metropolitan area with random shootings. As chief negotiator, Nosner assigned team members to craft messages communicating with the snipers through media statements. When the sniper left a tarot card saying, "Mr. Policeman, I am God," the team hoped to use this detail to verify future communications. After another shooting, investigators found a 4-page note demanding $10 million and bizarrely requesting police announce they had caught the sniper like a duck in a noose. Despite Nosner's recommendation to include this phrase in Chief Moose's public statement, senior FBI officials blocked it, a decision that may have cost bus driver Conrad Johnson his life on October 22nd when the sniper struck again. After retiring from the FBI in 2003, Nosner joined Control Risks, the world's premier kidnap response consultancy. From 2003 to 2008, he worked on a complex case involving three American defense contractors captured by FARC terrorists in Colombia. This challenging case highlighted both the strengths and weaknesses of government involvement. While U.S. agencies provided valuable intelligence support to Colombian military efforts, rigid thinking and outdated policies often hindered creative problem-solving that might have secured earlier release. Nosner's legacy extends far beyond the FBI. The negotiation techniques he pioneered have transformed how law enforcement agencies worldwide approach crisis situations. His core philosophy, that listening is the cheapest yet most effective concession we can make, has applications in business negotiations, international diplomacy, and even personal relationships. The evolution from rudimentary bargaining to sophisticated methodology represents one of law enforcement's most significant advancements. Early negotiators faced dual challenges, managing the hostage situation while also managing colleagues who preferred force over negotiation. Nosner helped shift the balance toward resolving crises without loss of life, with dramatic results. Perhaps most importantly, Nosner demonstrated that effective crisis management isn't about domination, but connection. Before influencing others, we must first listen and understand. This principle, simple yet profound, remains his most enduring contribution to the art of negotiation. Nosner's career, spanning from the 1980s through the early 2000s, coincided with a fundamental transformation in how law enforcement handles crisis situations. The shift from immediate tactical response to strategic negotiation has saved countless lives and influenced fields far beyond law enforcement. This evolution represented a dramatic departure from the storm and overwhelm tactics that had previously dominated crisis response, leading to a more nuanced and psychologically informed approach. The contrast between successes like Montana and failures like Waco offers powerful lessons about patience, communication, and the dangers of institutional arrogance. In Montana, negotiators successfully resolved a 16-day standoff with anti-government extremists through careful relationship building and strategic concessions. Conversely, Waco's tragic outcome stemmed from rushed tactical decisions and a breakdown in communication between negotiators and command. After Waco, significant FBI reforms emerged. Director Free created the Critical Incident Response Group, CIRG, placing HRT, behavioral profilers, crisis managers, and negotiators under unified command to ensure proper coordination. The FBI implemented the Hostage Barricade Database System, HOBAS, now the primary source of hostage data worldwide, which has helped standardize best practices and improve success rates across agencies. Beyond organizational changes, Nosner's approach to negotiation has revolutionized crisis response through four key principles: active listening, empathy without judgment, relationship building, and strategic patience. These techniques have proven invaluable not just in hostage situations, but in everyday conflicts. Whether dealing with an angry customer threatening legal action, a colleague resistant to change, or a family dispute over inheritance, his methods provide a systematic approach to de-escalate tension. For example, the BCSM method, Behavioral Change Stairway Model, he helped develop, guides practitioners through five stages: active listening, empathy, rapport, influence, and behavioral change. What makes Nosner's story particularly compelling is how it challenges our cultural narratives about heroism. In an era that often glorifies tactical solutions and dramatic rescues, his career demonstrates that the most heroic act might be simply listening to someone in crisis, creating space for them to be heard and understood. His experiences in cases like the Montana Freeman standoff showed how patience and empathy could succeed where force would likely have led to bloodshed. This patient, empathetic approach rarely makes headlines, but consistently saves lives, with negotiation success rates exceeding 90% in properly managed situations. As Nosner reflects, hostage negotiation involves managing yourself, your team, and your commanders, not just the person on the other end of the phone. The skills he developed improved his personal relationships and can help anyone become more effective in all areas of life. He emphasizes that emotional self-regulation is crucial. Negotiators must remain calm even when others lose control. This principle applies equally in boardrooms, classrooms, and family discussions. Before influencing others, we must first listen and understand. In crisis and in everyday life, listening remains the cheapest concession we can ever make, and often the most powerful, capable of transforming seemingly impossible situations into opportunities for resolution and growth.